Welcome to the Aaron Warner podcast on iCode Media. Today's a lot of fun because I have my good friend, mentor, and fellow podcast host, Chris Wolf, on with me. I had Chris recently audit our charts again for the second or third time. And so we talk a little bit about our journey from where we started in my office when he first audited the charts to where we're at now. But we really dive into a cool discussion about who our identity is, how we are as optometrists, why we are the kind of people we are, and what this journey looks like. So really hope you enjoy the conversation. I know Chris and I did, and definitely please support the sponsors and those who support us.
In the past, our focus revolved around prescribing MacuHealth or MacuHealth Plus to patients at risk of macular degeneration, while also recommending it to collegiate and professional athletes for enhanced contrast sensitivity and sports performance. However, this year's introduction of the Life Meter has been a game changer. The Life Meter revealed a concerning truth. Many of my patients have alarmingly low skin carotenoid levels, indicating potential deficiencies in essential body tissues like the retina and brain. Supported by over 30 peer-reviewed publications, Life Meter's accuracy, consistency, and effectiveness has been demonstrated across 2,000 subjects with diverse backgrounds. With this newfound insight, I can now have meaningful conversations about carotenoid levels with all of my patients, even those who may seem outwardly healthy. To learn more about this empowering technology, feel free to contact your MacuHealth representative or click on the link in the show notes. Together, let's optimize patient care and elevate their well-being. As doctors of optometry, we cannot do what we do without our team. And Paraoptometrics are allied health professionals who assist us in providing the highest level of vision care to our patients. We at iCode Education want to support you and your team in the paraoptometric certification process, which is why not only do we have resources available, training resources available for your team to help prepare them for the test, but we also have a discount code specifically for the Aaron Warner podcast listeners, which gives you $100 off for 12 months. So you can use the code AWP2024, that's AWP2024, to get $100 off for a 12-month code. We'll put the link in the show notes, but you can visit iCodeEducation.com and search for paraoptometric training to see what those courses are like.
It dawned on me when I was at a Padres game last year that baseball stats are up for everybody to see. When you go to a game, the batter comes to the plate, you see everything. If they're having a killer year, you see it. If they're struggling, you see it. And you can't hide. In fact, if they really screw up, you're going to watch them over and over and over again in slow motion with the pundits talking about everything they did wrong. So hopefully you do something right because you get a little bit of limelight for that as well. But I find it interesting that professional athletes get overanalyzed. I enjoy Taylor Swift's music. I'm not a Swiftie by any means, but I've seen tons of video on her. Lord knows, you know, poor thing can't even drink a beer at a football game without a camera on her, you know, commenting on how she's chugging the beer and who she's in the booth with. And these are professionals.
Yeah.
And we're professionals. And I found it interesting, and potentially it's how just my brain works, but I found it interesting that our athletes, our performers, professionals and the best in the world there get analyzed and hyperanalyzed. And as doctors, very seldom do we have somebody in the room with us analyzing us. Do we see ourselves on video performing? Do we even have somebody looking at what we're doing unless the big bad audit monster comes knocking on the door and we're afraid and then we're mad and we react accordingly. And it's not comfortable. I get it. But I found it very interesting and related it back to a conversation you and I had 2018, 2019, I think it was, when I said, I think I'm doing everything right, but I don't know if I am. And you said, well, I can take a look at your charts. And we were friends. We've been friends for a long time, but I got a little scared.
Did you? You know,
I
agree.
You're seeing me naked, right? Not literally. That's right. Figuratively, nope. Right? You're seeing, I can't hide.
Yep.
And you're a friend. I trust you. I respect you. And I'm afraid of the embarrassment that I was doing something wrong, that you were going to see the real me by looking at the charts. We got past it, but it was a fear.
Yeah, I think that fear is present. You know, you get a records request from, you know, another doctor who's taking over a patient, that patient moves or the patient's getting another opinion. And I think we all kind of get this little like, oh, did I, you know, kind of look over the chart and of course you're not changing anything, but you're looking over like, what are they going to find here that they're going to put up on a presentation about what Chris Wolf should have done instead of didn't do. And I think one of the things that, that I always think about is, two things in my mind. The first one is early on in my career, my dad had served as an expert witness for an optometrist who, long story short, the ophthalmologist basically said, this should have never happened. Like this should have never been done. And ultimately it was a bad comment on the ophthalmologist's part. The ophthalmologist actually, like in deposition after he had said that to the patient, right? He was like, I should have never said that. He was just commenting about like, you should never do X when this happens. And that wasn't true, but the patient had it in their mind and it wound up in a lawsuit. And the ophthalmologist knew it wasn't true, you know, but he was just kind of off the cuff. And then I also, I served as an expert witness, for a doc who, again, I look at it like I'm not going to serve as a witness against an optometrist. And this is the main reason is you never know what is said you never know what actually happens in that exam room. So my assumption is always that I'm giving the doctor a benefit of a doubt because these situations are complex. Things go bad. And ultimately the case that I served as an expert witness on got dismissed. It got thrown out. There was no real basis, but you're just like, you know, I guess my point in bringing that up, Aaron, is that I think we all kind of worry about that. But from an audit standpoint, you know, my approach is always like, look, there's positive intent every time. I did this lecture at Vision Expo East, and I always talk about the difference between abuse and fraud. And, you know, a lot of doctors are afraid of fraud, and fraud, you know, fraud when you know fraud when you see it. I don't know if John, when he was on with you a couple of weeks ago, if he was talking about this, but it's one of those things. I can't remember the old saying from the 90s when you and I were teenagers, but you know, there was this saying of, you know, this when you see it. And I think it was probably a little bit below the belt was what they were talking about, is my recollection. Yeah. But the point is like, just don't do fraud. And fraud is like intentionally billing for services you didn't provide, intentionally billing, you know, levels you didn't do. I mean, we just don't do that. I mean, optometrists don't do that. So the next part is like, let's just take a good look at ourselves. We'll assume good intent and we'll find things that are errors. You might find some abuse in the sense of like, well, you're always upcoding because you feel like this, you know, we've talked about that. People think, oh, it's a retina. It's a retina issue. And it's got to be a retina issue. It's got to be a level 4. And so that could be abuse. That could be even just like misuse, not even so much as abuse, but like, let's correct it, you know, and let's move on. And so I think when you take that approach, I look at it like I'm just trying to be helpful. I'm trying to analyze this as an outsider and then saying like, look, this is not something you should be ashamed of or worried about. What you should do is like, don't worry about being audited, like give the right care for the patient, do exactly the right thing, understand the rules, bill for what you've done. And then be confident that when somebody asks for your records, it's like, great, check a look at my records. They're wonderful, you know? And so how did you get over that, Aaron? I mean, I know this is your interview, but how did you get over that, the concern?
I trusted you, and the drive to do better for me was much stronger than any potential fear of embarrassment. Hmm. I mean, and I don't, maybe that's just inherent with me. I grew up wrestling, and so I, you know, in spandex in front of thousands of people with a spotlight on you. Same thing with you know, racing triathlons. You know, I've done silly things. I've been in environments where it's okay to tease and make fun of yourself, but the bigger drive was to do better. Actually, I take it back. The biggest drive was to reinforce, am I doing this right? Because up to that point, other than sending in some charts for a VSP audit or, you know, any other audit, and they come back and say, okay, you passed. Well, does that mean I was good? Does it mean I was bad? Does it mean I hit a certain threshold? I know I'm taking good care of patients, but are my charts good? Like, what does good look like? And so I think that was really the ultimate driver on how we can do better. You know, where am I at on this threshold of good? And then knowing that I could trust you, and you know, should I look really, really bad, you're not going to go tell the world. Thankfully,
no, that's right.
Right. We didn't come out like that, but yeah, I don't want to be the bad example on the Chris Wolf or the Rumpakis or Joe DeLoach lecture, right?
Yeah, no, and I think the cool part for me is we have always been really interested in helping people who want to help. You know, I'm not that interested in helping people who just kind of want me to rubber stamp what they've done or just give them the answer that they want to hear. And what was really cool is when we did this again for you this last year, is you, it was like, I wasn't having to, we were beyond the conversation of like, hey, Aaron, you know, you did this, you could have used this code instead, or had you done this, you would have been able to use this code. Like, not just Aaron, but like pretty much your whole team was doing things generally the right way. I mean, there was a couple cases that we can talk about, but a couple cases of under recognizing the fact that a condition is a chronic condition with an acute flare up that was under coded. But again, those are very common, and we were able to remedy that. And I think these light bulbs went off in the doctors that work with you. And then the other thing that was again common, although I don't think we caught any of this, but it was just the conversation of, I feel like this should be more complicated because it's a potential retinal issue, and yeah, it's just not. And so so that was, but that, you know, we talked about a few of those things, but they weren't like these huge errors that would really have made a big difference. And nor should you be, or any of the doctors in your team have been ashamed about making those errors. But what was really fun is to be able to dive into some of the things that we're doing in Comprehensive Optometry Simplified, is to be able to say, like, let's take a look at prevalence data. And you and John had a great conversation about this. It's like, but it was from the other angle. You know, my angle is, when I look at data from providers, both collectively, when we look at data pools, like CMS data pools, but also individually, I have been shocked to wonder what is going on when you look at prevalence data and compare what you're expecting to see versus what you actually do see. And so that was a lot of fun to work with you guys, because I was able to kind of run some reports and be like, hey, wow, okay, prevalence data, you guys are right on what we would expect based on prevalence data for patients with macular degeneration and glaucoma and dry eye, especially because Brittany does so much dry eye. But then when we looked at the individual providers, I think I was able to have a more meaningful conversation with them, because I was able to say, like, listen, you would expect in your patient population to have this many patients out of this many, you know, if you've got 1,000 patients, I would expect to see this many patients that have this disease. So why aren't you doing the tests that commensurate with that? Are you seeing, and so then the answers there's all these answers, and you've gone through them. You know, there's almost like this, although you guys didn't have it, I think because you had already kind of accepted that you want to do better. You've accepted that what I'm going to tell you is real and true. And then you were able to kind of see it in your own data. But the common thing that we see, and you can observe this as well, when you discuss this data is, no, that's not my population. Your metrics don't apply to my population. You know, I'm going to remove reality and insert my own, you know. It's, so you get that. And what's the curve called? What's the curve you share with me?
That was the Kubler-Ross change curve. It's the kind of an expansion of the emotional reaction to change and the six stages of grief kind of, but with the positive swing at the end of it. And so that we felt that, I think we hit it a little bit, but the first time we worked with you back in 2019. And if I'm remembering the first time we did this back then, I'll stick with the baseball analogy. I felt like we were playing baseball, but it was stick ball in the street. I mean, not to the care that we were giving, but when it came to our charts and our
fair enough.
our confidence in the charts.
Yeah.
Right. You know, if somebody would have said, hey, who's got the best documented charts in the room? I don't think I would have raised. I know I wouldn't have raised my hand, right? Because I don't know what mine looks like compared to anybody else's. I've never had somebody look and tell us. And so there was that lack of confidence because we didn't know where we fit on the scale, again, back in 2019. So when you may remember things a little bit better than I do, but what I remember is you saying, hey, you guys are doing a good job. You could probably be a little bit more clearer when you're ordering tests. I can deduce why you ordered it, but you could be clear in your documentation as to why you're ordering it. You know, we like most of our colleagues, I think, want to say, hey, this patient is diabetic, therefore I can run these tests because I have this code, right? I want to paint my number. And so you helped us understand the rules of medical necessity. There's not a specific flow chart of this diagnosis matches with these tests, but there's a reason to do them. And all you have to do is justify your reason to do them and write it out like a story. And then you laughed and said, well, you guys are clearly optometrists because you are giving exceptional care and going above and beyond, but you're coding like you're not. And since significantly undercoding, I think we had, you know, close to $100,000 in just additional revenue should we have coded appropriately, which I've learned is pretty common.
But your practice has, I'm not taking credit for this because I think you all really wanted to do things better. You saw an opportunity to enhance the care you're providing through assigning value to the care that you are already providing, which is sort of a conundrum to people, I think, is really, in my opinion, the way I see this, again, maybe I step back a little bit. I think a lot of your listeners may have heard me talk about this before, Aaron, but my history in the profession is sort of like I really care about patient access to optometric services, to the fullest expanse of optometric service, to our fullest extent of our knowledge, education, and training. And one of the things I see so vividly, and I think it's becoming more and more clear as time goes on, is patients aren't really limited from optometry's, the vast majority of what optometry does, because of legislative issues or because of insurance issues. They're purely limited by the limitations that we set within ourselves. And I think most of the time, and that seems like a lot of self-help kind of stuff. And I don't know, I guess maybe it is, but I think when I look at what happens in an optometric practice and I try to boil it down to kind of like this behavioral economics, Aldo Zuccario, I'll call him a friend. I could call him a good friend. I think he's a great guy. I really like him. He's a behavioral economist, and I've had him on the podcast a couple times.
Yeah, great episodes. I love listening.
Thanks. And what I learned from him is like what I really think about is the economic drivers that of the things that we do that we are not aware of. And I think there's so much of that exists in the psyche of optometrists, and it probably exists in other professions as well. But I know our profession, and I am an optometrist, right? Yeah. And so I feel all the same things that an optometrist feels, right? Like any other optometrist feels. Yeah. But most of it is these little like things in our lizard brain that drive what we do. And it's not about like, you know, are we trained well enough? Or is this thing going to make me money? That's not the front part of our mind. It's in the back part of our mind. It has to be because every optometrist I know, and I've said this comment and I've said it even more strongly than I'll say it here because I think it's true, but I could offend people, so I will not. But I'll say it as softly as I can, is that every single optometrist I know is a good human being. Like really deep down, they're good people. And we just want to take care of patients, and we just want to like make patients happy. And you made a good point when we were talking about this recently, which I'll let you make if you decide. But, and because of all of that, we avoid any potential for, often we'll avoid potential for uncertainty. So in uncertain situations, we want to test everything, but then we don't have a code to bill to. or we see something that's kind of on the edge of our comfort. And so just because, you know, we don't want to be stuck holding the bag if the patient has a bad outcome, we just let somebody else take a look at it. We are afraid to recommend treatments that may be new, but also effective, like proven to be effective, because we're worried about a patient having an outcome that is not optimal, or we're worried about having to oversell that thing. And when we oversell it, the patient doesn't have the as perfect of an experience, and we don't know how to get out of that. So I say all that to
say that disappointing people.
Yeah. We don't. I don't like to disappoint people. I mean, I was listening to an attorney. I've been paying very close attention to a case that's going on right now. And I was listening to an attorney who was a defense attorney in the case. And she was saying on this podcast, she was saying that as a defense attorney, she is used to having people hate her. And at some point you just stop caring. And, you know, I mean, I don't think that optometrists need to stop caring, but we have to do what's right. And sometimes doing what's right is internally challenging, and we have to figure out how to do that. And I think a lot of times it comes down, if we're boiling it down to what your situation was and what we see all the time, is that if and why we do what we do at iCode is, if people are afraid of doing things, or they're afraid of getting paid, or they're afraid of getting audited, then what happens is they do less. And when they do less, the patient has access to all of their services less frequently, yes, and to a lesser extent than they otherwise could. And so that's really the that's a huge, long, meandering diatribe. I hope people are able to follow it, but that's sort of the genesis of iCode. It's like, you guys are great, like well-trained, better trained than, you know, any generation before you. And yet here we are not doing the things that we're trained to do. What, that doesn't make any intuitive sense. So is it that we don't understand the value, or we're afraid of all those other things we talked about? So that's what we've worked on with iCode, is helping offices do all those things effectively.
And I know. I think you said it very well. I'll try to bring it back to an example. And AMD, right? I remember in school, I had a professor who drilled into us, never have your name be the last name on a chart.
Yeah, yeah.
It was also the same professor who said, you need to be everything to everyone. And you need to know everything about VT. You need to know low vision. You need to be an expert scleral fitter. You need to know neuro and be able to figure out these crazy neuro. Like, you need to be everything to everyone. You need to make them happy, because you got to get them to 2020 at worst, you know, ideally 2015. And so I think it's a combination of who we are as people. You know, we love the science, we're nerds. I think that we elected not to go into emergency room because the high stress, just environment wasn't who we are as individuals. And I'm talking grand scheme. There's certainly those of us that are different, right?
And, yeah, I mean, we're making broad generalizations, of course.
Exactly.
Right? And I think also it's important. Yeah, no, I think it's also important, Aaron, to note that like all of these things are things that you and I have struggled with. I mean, clearly, you know, you were doing these things just a few years ago. I feel like I've struggled with them internally, and I've struggled with them with our clients in iCode. Is like, look, I understand where you're coming from. I understand why you want to do these things, but by doing things this way, it you're frustrated. You're frustrated right now. Yeah. You're going to continue to be frustrated. You're not going to be happy with the reimbursements you're getting with from you know, X, Y, and Z managed vision care. So I at the risk of saying like, you guys aren't doing things right, that's not what we're saying at all. And I know it's not what you're saying.
No, it's definitely not what I'm saying. I looking back on my progression development as an optometrist, that I continue to do so. You know, the more I learn, the more I realize I don't know. And I continue to learn. So much so that my kids laugh at me because I listen to, you know, podcasts and audio stuff in the car to try to learn more. But really, when it comes to the charting, that's where we started on this, it was a confidence issue. Right. And if I'm I'm thinking of billing and coding in the, and I'm worried of the audit boogie monster. I'm going to stay a few feet back from that electric fence. I'm worried about getting shocked. And I know that I only get shocked if I touch the fence, but I'm just going to stay 5 feet back, because then for sure I'm not even going to be able to reach out my arm and touch it. And if 5 feet's good, 7 feet might even be better, right? So we really just try to err on the side of being safe, really, because we don't know any different. And in school, we're not allowed to fail, right? Which is a good thing. There's plenty of safety nets. In practice, we definitely don't want to fail. Because now we're disappointing patients. So I think that unless we've got a mentor, we proactively seek out opportunities like this to say, hey, where am I at? We don't know. And so we were coding and, I mean, documenting, you know, being able to describe ordering tests a little bit better. Great feedback. Undercoding was hey, I'm not going to push the needle because I've heard the horror stories and I just don't want to be in the spotlight. Until we walk through that process and you say, oh no, you're good. Like you, everything here was clear. You walked through the charts, the rules of the game. At that time in 2019, it was even more complex than it is now.
Yeah.
But you just said, hey, here's exactly how it is, right? If I'm an auditor, here's the matrix I put you up against, and you're fine. You did this, which gave us the confidence to say, oh yeah, we are. And so we can immediately start acting on that now confidence that we have. I'm still not going to touch that fence, but I'm going, oh, we got a little bubble pop up.
Yeah, you got a little thumbs up.
I'm not going to touch the fence, but I can get really close to it, right? And I can feel confident now that I'm doing the right thing. And if I do get that spotlight shined on me, I'm confident to have that conversation to say, see, look, everything I did, I've got the matrix right here. And I think that was a big help.
Yeah. So I think the things that we've learned is, I mean, certainly when we audit charts and sit down with people and kind of explain what's going on, they have this kind of eye opening, like, ah, okay. All right. So there's these different levels of things that we've learned over the years, actually, of like, how do you actually do this? So one thing I see often is people just want to be able to say, like, well, I'm going to do this now. And I'm going to do it the same way every single time. And then it's going to be fine. But as you know, like rules change, things change, you get new codes. I mean, G2211 is a new code that if you don't know, if you're not aware of it and you're not confidently using it right now, I mean, you're losing revenue. And I'll tell you, Aaron, there's probably my estimate is that already in optometric practices, we have probably lost in what, 3 months, almost 3 months of having access to this code. I mean, millions of dollars across the country have been lost because people haven't educated themselves on this. And they'll be like, what are they talking about? Right. And that's fine. Okay. There's lots of resources for you out there and we have them. But to add certainty and clarity, and yet here we are, we're just going to keep chugging along, doing the same thing, undervaluing the things. So I think the ultimate thing is the audits are really helpful, I think, to bring people back in and to just show them what's going on.
The audits that you do.
That we do.
That you and
the friendly audits.
Not friendly audits, thank you. Not the boogeyman audit, but the friendly audit that's going to give that positive feedback, that coaching, and then you can have a discussion with.
Yeah, because there's finite things, and they publish these things. Like there's finite reasons that people fail, and it's super simple. You and John covered them, but basically, it's no chief complaint. Which doesn't establish medical necessity. So the whole, you know, so your visit doesn't have a medical necessity, or your tests don't have medical necessity. And then outside of that, it's like sloppy stuff. Like you didn't sign your paper, or you just didn't sign your chart, or you didn't have any other like explanation of your diagnosis. I mean, it's stuff that you wouldn't do. It's stuff that people just don't do typically. And so like, that's easy. Those things aren't hard, but knowing like, how do I order? Like you said, how do I order appropriately? But what we've learned in iCode is I can't just teach people how to do those things well, and it solves all their other problems. Because then the next question is, well, how do I handle, is it routine or medical? And then if you can't get over that, then it's kind of like, well, I'll use my 99 codes for acute care, but I don't really like, I haven't really confidently had a good conversation on how to talk about whether it's routine or medical, how do I discuss copays? How do I discuss deductibles? When I bill something and my EOB comes back denied, how do I read that EOB? Like, that's a real challenge for people, especially if they don't have the infrastructure around them. And then, you know, if they haven't analyzed their data, if they don't know that, you know, in our clinical practice guidelines, the AOA clinical practice guidelines, the American Academy of Ophthalmology's preferred practice patterns tell us what we ought to do for conditions. Now, you can deviate from that, of course, but if you deviate away from that in less, like by providing less care, you really ought to wonder why you're doing that. Like, why am I going away from what is being recommended? Is there a good reason? Or is it that I just don't really like doing fields? I just don't really like doing gonioscopy. You know, I mean, that's what we have to ask ourselves that. And so what we found is we help people analyze their data so then they can understand like their metrics and know, am I performing well? Am I performing in a way that I would expect? Then I know the rules. I know how to apply the codes. And then I know, like, what do our guidelines say? Like, not me, but we make sure people are refreshed on what our clinical practice guidelines are. I've talked to many of externs that I say, what do our clinical practice guidelines say about asymptomatic retinal tears? What's a clinical practice guideline? They'll say, like, what? What's a clinical practice guideline? Like, well, this is where it is. It's amazing. And then how do you incorporate those into your specific practice? Because your practice, Aaron, looks different than my practice. And what we've learned a lot is if I come in and tell you, do all these things because it works in my practice, it will not work in yours. And it won't work. And the reason it won't work in yours is because the system I have proposed isn't a good system. It's because you haven't owned it. You haven't taken ownership of that thing. And so that's really what we've been focused on and having a lot of fun helping practices with within iCode and Comprehensive Optometry Simplified.
No, absolutely. So that was a lot. I want to unpack a couple of things.
Yeah, sorry.
One is it's fantastic. But so you talked about the data, and a realization that I had is that I'm late to the game. I'm sure listeners already know this, but the best way to overcome fear is by learning in fact. Right. If we let our emotions run wild, the boogeyman comes out big time. Right. I can make a mountain out of any molehill if I let my emotions just start playing into it and I let my brain start running and processing, and that's all the woulda, shoulda, couldas, what might happen. When I start looking at the numbers and the data as what it is, now I can make clear decisions. I know what to focus on, what not to focus on, because we're doing it well. I know what to get rid of, because it's not helpful. A perfect example is the managed vision cares, and totally different rabbit hole. And you and Kyle actually had a really good discussion on Adam Smalley's podcast about it. But it's easy to look at the exam refractive reimbursement on a managed vision care plan and emotionally say, I like it or I don't. What's a little bit more challenging is extrapolating it to, well, how much am I bringing in from those patients in my optical? What's really powerful is when you start extrapolating to say, hey, is that plan, maybe it's not paying me very much on this one visit, but am I generating a lot of medical revenue and a lot more visits because that plan is now a giant marketing opportunity for my practice that's really allowing me to care for more people and take financial care of the practice as well. And the numbers, when you start looking into them, are helpful. You know, I can say as well, and go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that. Go ahead, please. Yeah.
I was going to say it. And the same thing happens when you are, when we're practicing and treating patients. I know what percentage of my patients are buying in the optical. I know that number, right? We're selling 70% of our patients are buying lenses and 60% of our patients are buying frames. Right? We track that on a monthly basis. Up until recently, if somebody would have asked me, hey, are you catching all your glaucoma patients and are you treating them appropriately? I would have said, absolutely. I don't miss anything. And I'm doing all the tests as I should. We start running numbers. I had a little bit of a wake-up moment that, you know, I might probably ought to grab my gonio lens once or twice more than I'm doing right now. And I think that's probably, except for the one or two of you listening and screaming at me right now, probably pretty common if we start running our numbers saying, hey, here's some areas of opportunity that I'm not thinking of on a daily basis that I'm missing, but when you run the numbers, you are. So the data and understanding the facts and seeing the numbers really help to overcome the boogeyman and help us do better.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's the same old adage of like, you can't improve what you don't measure. And it also, you know, people make gut reactions with vision plans. You know, they just get fed up and then they're done, but they don't. And so they may change because they're just so done, right? That they abandon it, but that they don't really understand what they're leaving behind if they haven't analyzed what that vision plan is driving in their practice. Alternatively, if you really are done with a vision plan, then great. Figure it out and figure out how you're going to, like, what the impact is going to be on your practice and how you're going to overcome that in a strategic way so that there's less uncertainty in it. And that's my whole thing is not to drop vision plans and it's not to keep vision plans. It's to say, look, I'm making a strategic business decision for my patients. And sometimes you'll find that if you are, you know, integrating a lot of different care and you understand what that care is and what the data tells you, you'll find that a vision plan that might pay you, you know, a fifth or a sixth of what your usual and customary fees are. But if you're paying attention to prevalence data in that patient, you're not just changing patients because you're willy-nilly changing them. But if you're paying attention to things that our guidelines tell us we should pay attention to, then those patients often are gonna generate a lot more revenue for your practice. And then you can sit back and be like, yeah, it stinks that on this service I'm giving away my care. But when I give away my care here, I have access to these patients who need help. And oh, by the way, nobody else in my community is gonna give them help the way I'm gonna give them. And so that's not to say, and again, there's lots of great docs in Omaha, but I believe they all say the same thing. They should say the same thing. Like, I don't think I'm doing a whole lot of different things than anybody else can or does do, but there's a certain number of patients that like my personality, like my approach to patient care. And there's a whole bunch of others that don't. And so, and they're going to be great. They're going to be the best place for them is going to be the guy that's a block down the road or a mile down the road or wherever they are, you know, they're just going to prefer that level of care. That's fine. That's not saying anything bad about anybody else. It's just that, if we understand all those things, we can make better decisions one way or the other way.
Yep. 100% about just making the best decision that's right for the patient and for the practice, right? I'm lumping the staff and the doctors and everybody in that practice, and knowing what you're doing, knowing the story that you're writing in your chart, knowing what you're treating, you're building your identity. Right. So you don't have to be that someone for everyone. You have to be that. You're laughing because you've got a wonderful talk on identity that I love listening to. So
thanks.
Piggybacking a little bit and stealing. But when you know who you are, you can be a better you. When you don't know who you are, it's really hard to be you because now you're swayed by the judgments of your patients. And earlier you mentioned the story on it. I think you were referencing my thoughts on how we're emotionally driven, and one of the biggest fear factors we have is the Yelp rating. Right? When you get that email that says, "Hey, you got a new Google review or you got a new Yelp review," I remember that was the only time in my life that my anxiety would spike up, and I would have to take a breath before I opened the email. And it was a long time before I realized I don't care about the one stars. Now I'll read it. And I'll look to see, hey, was there something we can learn and improve from this? Some of them were just crazy, and I'm not their cup of tea, right? And if they need to vent that to the world, that's great. They can vent it to the world. But because I know who I am and I have confidence in the care that I give, I'm not beholden emotionally to their thoughts about me. What was really interesting is we bought a practice and incorporated that practice into ours. And very different philosophies on how we approach patient care. We take the word comprehensive, exams to the T, and our pre-testing is almost about 25 minutes long because of all the different tests we do. And we recognize that we're doing that and giving things away, but I want to be able to identify and then bring patients back and treat as appropriate. He was the opposite. He how quick can I get them through? They're here basically to get glasses. That's what I'm going to do for them. Mm. We had quite a few patients who were really upset because they did not want the comprehensive care that we were giving.
Yeah.
And they wanted what I was offended.
Yeah.
I got $500,000 in the pretest room and you don't care about any of it because all you wanted was a, was your prescription, right? And it took you that long. And it took me a while to be okay with the fact that I'm good. If I'm not your guy, don't come here. Right. But this is who we are. And then I was able to help my staff in, be able to say the same thing. Hey, that's not who we are. Right. If that's what you want, totally cool. Across the street, down the block, anybody else will take care of you. But this is what we do. And it became a sense of pride, not telling people no, but it became a sense of pride of saying, this is the level that we're at and we're not going to compromise on our level. And we blossomed and grew the more we know who we were.
Yeah. I think, I mean, it's so powerful. I was on a, I was on a call last night with some people who we were looking at some data related to, related to eye examinations in kids. And, you know, one of the things that got brought up was, what does this say about our identity? Actually, one of the things that got brought up was, what does this say about, you know, Atomic Habits, which is a book that, that talks about the habits that we build. But ultimately, what you can boil things down to is what does it say about who we believe we are? You know, who, you know, we've talked, so I don't want to go into that discussion except to say that it was just illuminating because a lot of, that's why I love looking at data. It's like, when I look at data, I look at it and it's like, this tells me about who we believe we are collectively. You know, it, it tells me about, like, because our behaviors reinforce our identity. And so that, and that, again, the Atomic Habits, it's a great book.
Great
but,
book, yeah.
You know, the things that, that Aaron Warner does, I mean, like I look at the way you, you work on your practice and I don't know, you could probably tell me what this says about my, my practice, but I work on my practice, but I don't work on my practice like you work on your practice. And so in some of the ways that you do, and so it's like, that he knows exactly what he's doing. He knows exactly what he's doing as far as like, let's do a good job clinically, but he also knows the levers to push business and also how to, how he's going to analyze all those things. Well, it tells me a lot about you. And so, so like I, in a lot of ways, I admire you for the stuff that you're doing related to that. And I think, well, when I don't look at this, I mean, there's a lot of stuff I look at, but don't get me wrong. But, yeah. But I think like, wow, okay, well, when I'm not looking at this and Aaron's looking at that, does that, I'm not like jealous or anything. I'm just saying like, does this say something different? Am I actually loosey goosey? Like, am I actually think I'm a little like in some things I'm very rigorous and other things I'm kind of loosey. It's like, well, I don't know. It's just like, it's just, you know, not that big a deal, you know? But anyway, my point is like, it tells you about my identity, like in my identity for whatever that one thing is. And I really can't think of one thing off the top of my head, but I know that there's things like, I need to be harder on this. I need to be more stringent on others. Really, it boils down to, it's like, I don't want to place things on others. I'm not good at that. Like, I'm not good at like really shifting over and I'm good at delegating. But when I have to completely remove myself or when I should completely remove myself, I find like I'm not as good at like letting somebody come and report back to me. I was talking to Frederick about that this last weekend. And, anyway, my point is that I'm not as good as I'd like to be in some of those areas. And I wonder if it, what it says about me in that specific area that I'm way less rigorous, than I ought to be. And the point of all of that is just to say, you could probably cut it all out. It's just to say our behaviors, it's very interesting to watch what people do. And that's the most interesting part, I think, about what we do at iCode is to be able to see what people do and then try to figure out why are they doing that? And what is that? Then taking the next step, what does that say about their identity? Because if you can change their identity, then you can change their behaviors or they can change their behaviors. So if they can change their identity, yeah.
Well, what I think you just said is that you know who you are, right? Okay. And knowing who you are means you know your strengths and it knows your weaknesses or areas for opportunity. And you've done a very good job of bringing people around you that complement your your personality. Kyle Clute is a perfect example. You know, I'm appreciative for you giving me a platform on iCode Media. And you and I are very
thanks for different. Doing it. You know, doing a great job.
It's a fun thing.
I don't like to listen to my episodes, but I love to listen to yours. This one's going to be weird.
Well, I say the exact same thing. Yeah. It's going to be weird to listen to this one in the car.
Yeah.
But I think that right. You have complementary personalities, and I call you to ask you for stuff and areas that I'm not good at. You know, the Neuralink study was a prime example. I knew you would see it slightly differently, and I trusted the perspective that you were going to bring to say, hey, I'm something's not all adding up here, but I'm not quite connecting the dots. Like, well, what am I missing? Let's talk through this. Right. And your episode was amazing. And the rabbit hole you went down to do all the research, presented it, it made perfect sense. But my mind just wasn't connecting those dots to get there, which I really appreciated. And I'm going to use that to kind of circle back to the audit thing, which is what we were supposed to talk about. But the most recent audit we did, because we knew the rules of the game a little bit better, you know, building off of what we've done in the past, we were able to really refine a lot of things. And one of the cool things that I came out of it was, and you alluded to it earlier, about the exacerbation of a chronic condition and what you're doing, right? So there was a couple of charts, if I recall, where a patient had presented with an internal herniolum and doc treated it as appropriate, put them on oral doxy, and billed it as level 3. And you read through the notes and you said everything you did in that chart was perfectly correct. But I'm going to challenge you to take one step back. Why did they have that internal herniolum? And we walked through and you said, hey, it's either MGD or you've got blepharitis or whatnot, which is a chronic condition. And now this is an exacerbation. Recognizing that and adding that to the story is not doing anything wrong. It's just making the story more complete. And you're going to treat that patient for the chronic condition in addition to the acute symptom that they're having. But because you recognize that, you also get to bill for that as appropriate because you're taking, you know, full and better care of the patient. To me, it wasn't a paint by numbers, hey, they've got internal herniolum, now I get to bill higher. It was take a step back and just look at the patient a little bit bigger as a patient, right? Look at everything that's involved and appreciate your knowledge and application of that knowledge to the patient. And then get paid for it.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really, really cool because now you go from do this, bill this to here's how it's supposed to work. Here's how you're supposed to think about things. And that kind of stuff was cool now that we've gotten to this point because light bulbs are going off, you know, even more. And I've seen that be reflective in mine and my associate doctor's charts and their notes and in their billing.
That's great to hear. I think, you know, the point I'll put on that is a lot of times people mishear this or they misinterpret it to just be like, well, just throw in another condition. You know, well, they came in for an internal herniolum. They probably have. And that's not what you're saying. I know it's not what you're saying because that's not what we've talked about. But they hear that and that is not the point. The point is what I would have never known, but I look back at the previous record to say, well, it's interesting. Because my thought always is with a lot of the ocular surface stuff is that there's very few acute ocular surface conditions. Most of them are related to eyelids as well. Most of them are related to more chronic issues. And that's just from years of clinical experience, right? It's from years of practicing and wondering and being curious about what we're seeing. And so I go back and I look and sure enough, in both of those situations, in the past family social history, it said, you know, one of the conditions that they had was MGD. So it was like, you know, it was applicable to this visit, but all you had to do is look like read the history of the patient's chart. And I know I'm looking at that and saying, well, I wonder, and I don't know, maybe not, maybe it wasn't. Maybe the doctor at the time didn't think that it was related to the MGD, and that's totally legitimate. But my curiosity was, well, is it? Like, do we just get internal herniolums like randomly? No, most of the time I'm thinking it's probably an acute flare-up of a more chronic issue. And so recognizing that is important. And I think it lets you be the doctor, right? Like, what are we trained to do? We're trained to obtain the history we care about. We're trained to review records. to know the patient and to develop a relationship with the patient so we can provide a higher level of care. And that's what optometry does. But, you know, we have the opportunity to do all these things. So just
care, now we're getting recognized for that.
Now too. You get recognized for it. Yeah, we get recognized for it in the appropriate 99 code, and we also are getting recognized for it in the appropriate add-on code. So that becomes really rewarding. I'm glad that has made a difference in your practice.
It hasn't. It's, I think it's elevated the enjoyment and care, right? The treating the puzzle and looking at it like a puzzle and solving the mystery, right? And now you can treat the underlying condition. You can treat the patient. You can have a higher level discussion with the patient. It's pretty neat. We've got a lot of really cool tools that help with that. I don't know if you guys have brought in even the life meter yet, but
there's
the discussions I'm having because of a finger reading off somebody at the beginning, right? And how that impacts them. And it's not to sell a bottle of supplements by any means. It's to have a deeper conversation and really just build on what we did in school. I mean, in school, we were curious and we wanted to learn, and we were developing new contact lens designs on the back of notebooks because we had this crazy idea that we were going to build out. You know, somewhere along the way, I think we lost that in the minutia of practice. But understanding, you know, the rules and the theory of the game, and you've helped us get to the confidence through the audits and the discussions to do that. You know, it's adding a lot more fun back in taking care of the patients.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's exactly what that's what we want, right? Like, that's the whole goal, is we want to love what we do. I want to walk into the office, know I'm doing a great job for patients, walk out at the end of the day and know we did a good job, and then be financially rewarded for it.
Yeah. And speaking of financial rewarding, I don't recall off the top of my head what the cost is for the audit with you, but I know when I looked at it both times, within a matter of weeks, we had recouped, right? Because it's there's not a whole lot of things that are that quick that you can track the return, and more than, you know, quadrupled, probably more like 20 to 30 times the return easily.
Thanks.
Just in proper billing and coding, not doing anything different than we're already doing care wise, just appreciating and recognizing the value that we're giving, and just assigning the right number to that.
Yeah. Thanks. I think that's part of what we've developed as well, is not just like we come in and look at it once, but you get access to all the other resources. So if I say, hey, go and look at this and look at X, Y, and Z, we've talked through that. You can say, I think I understood what Chris said, but let me watch this again, or let me look at that again, or I'm going to email, or I'm going to jump on this mastermind office hour session. I'm going to just pick your brain a little bit more about this. Like, that's what we do. I mean, that's why we've got it. And so it's, that's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, it has been. And it's been a little bit different too. I've gone to plenty of classes from other presenters and smart doctors, great people, you know, but it was too much of the, hey, bill this and look what you get paid. Look what you get paid.
Yeah.
And that never felt right to me, because I don't think that's why I went into that. Certainly I want to comfortable life.
Sure.
But I always thought that once I do the right thing, you know, the life will take care of me back, not the other way around. And so, but having that discussion of how should you approach this, you know, is it medical or is it,
routine?
Know, refractive, right? Routine. Yep. Is it, you know, it, I've finally been able to eliminate the diabetic exam that's non-existent, because every patient is different. And what are you going to, you know, there's no such thing.
Oh, that's a big hang up for people too. Yeah.
And it's, I think it's simply because we just, it seems so complicated.
Yeah.
I don't think it is once you scale it down, but it feels so complicated that I just need help in just tell me what to do. Right. I wanted to give good care. I think I give good care. It's this whole billing and numbers coding side that's odd, but understanding the rules, and the first part was just, look, where am I at right now? And once we understand where we're at right now, we know where to build off of. And then you don't have to worry about that, you know, diabetic exam anymore, but now you can take care of a patient who has diabetes and
that's
whatever state they're in.
Yep. Amen.
So I still have a lot to learn. Appreciate you as a mentor and more so as a friend. So, and making time to do all this with me and then have a discussion about it.
Well, thanks so much, Aaron, for obviously for your friendship for all the years. You know, you're a grandfather now. I know you may have mentioned that on the podcast. And what's so cool is I had a realization this last weekend that when you and I met, your son, I mean, he probably had to be 2 years old, 2 or 3 years old. And now now you got a grandson. So super cool. Yeah. I mean, your it's oldest son, cool. I know you got other kids, but super cool. It's been a blessing in my life, to know you, Aaron. And, thanks so much for your friendship and your mentorship, and guidance, man. I mean, it all comes down to all of that stuff. So I got to ask you, we're going to work out, in Orlando, aren't we?
We are going to work out in Orlando. I've got a love-hate relationship with the ODARK 30 Chris Wolf workouts, but
it's great. I'll plan one. Then.
We'll be there.
I'll plan one.
Definitely right. plan cool. one. Yeah.
Thanks awesome. For doing this, man. Thanks, I appreciate man. It. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you.